Good morning, and thanks for having me.
And as we look back to that pivotal Freedom Summer of 1964, 50 years ago, we want to know right now, what are your thoughts and questions about that era as we speak with Jacksonville author Charlie Cobb? And if you're old enough, share your memories of that time with us. Give us a call. The number to join First Coast Connect right now, 549-2937. Again, that's 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us. This is so fascinating because the conventional narrative that's taken hold, as you've said before, is Rosa Parks sat down, Martin Luther King stood up, and all was made right with the world nonviolently. That's not necessarily how it all went down, and you were there.
It doesn't even come close to describing how it went down. We could take a couple of hours to
right.
detail all of this. The main point I like to make in describing the Southern movement of the 1950s and 60s, that it grows out of the longer tradition of community organizing, which at the grassroots, which goes all the way back to the beginning of the country. Slave revolts essentially are that. After all, people were not having sit-ins at the plantation manor dining room table or marching on auction blocks. They were organizing something, usually covertly at the grassroots. And that tradition is very, very old. And one of the things about the movement that's misunderstood, given the drama of protest marches, Selma, Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama, or even the Mississippi summer of 1964, one of the things that's not fully understood is really the movement was a movement of quiet organizing work at the grassroots in the rural South, places that, if unless you know them, don't appear on your mental map of political struggle.
Sure. And the rural South, culturally, you write, was made up of folks who were armed. And underpinning the nonviolent moral authority of the movement was the threat, the implicit threat, that if pressed hard enough, lethal force would have to be used. Is that the main argument?
Well, people in the South, black or white, Southern had guns, particularly in rural areas. It's just a part of the culture, as much a part of the culture as blue jeans are. And people really didn't have those guns just for purposes of self-defense. In fact, I would argue that in the rural areas, people mostly had guns to put food on the table. They were poor. They went out hunting. Or they used guns to chase varmints out of the gardens that they had. And secondarily, they use guns for self-defense. Now, there's several different kinds of reasons for that when you look at the black community. You first see guns in black communities in significant ways after the Civil War, when black soldiers who had fought in the Union Army come back home. And you really see that in a very dramatic way and in a way that impacts the movement of the 1950s and 60s with World War II. Mm-hmm. Where soldiers were overseas fighting Nazis and Japanese fascists and Italian fascists under the banner of democracy. They come back home and don't find much of it.
Yeah.
But they also come back home with guns. And you see a noticeable shift in white violence after World War II. Before World War II, violence directed at black people are what took the form of what a historian friend of mine calls spectacle lynchings. You put an ad in the newspaper and we say, we're going to lynch Melissa this weekend. Y'all come and bring the kids. And you see these photographs.
Yeah, they're absolutely horrifying.
Yeah. Well, after World War II, there's a shift. You don't really see much of that. What you see are covert things. They're planting bombs under churches. Or they are assassinating people as they did for Harry T. and Harriet Moore here in Mims, Florida in 1951. You see assassinations as you saw with Martin Luther King or Medgar Evers, because what Ku Klux Klansmen and other terrorists have learned in the post-war period is that the people they attack are increasingly inclined to shoot back. And a lot of these people inclined to shoot back are World War II veterans and Korean War veterans. And I talk about that at some length in the book.
And we'll go to your calls in just a moment for Jacksonville's own Charlie Cobb, the award-winning author and journalist, is out with a new book getting national attention. It's called This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. Can you tell us a little bit about your memories of that time? You served as the field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee for 5 years, primarily in Mississippi. Share with us, if you could, some of your anecdotes and memories from that era that that came back to you as you were writing this.
Well, the first thing, whenever I think about the South or Mississippi in those days, because it was so startling to me back then in 1962 when I came to Mississippi, was the level of violence. I mean, you just didn't have that where I came from. I went to high school in Massachusetts. I was born in Washington, D.C. And yeah, we knew stuff about police brutality and harassment, but nothing that came close to
the terrorism of what was going on
in
there.
Mississippi.
Yeah,
or in much of the Black Belt South. And then the big surprise for me when I thinking about what that experience was like was the strength that I found in these rural communities. I came to Mississippi with the usual kinds of stereotypes in my head. The people are downtrodden and oppressed, and they can't resist this. On the other hand, when you get into these communities, you find these incredibly strong people. Fannie Lou Hamer comes to mind. She goes down to register to vote. The word gets back to the plantation. Before she gets back, she's greeted by the plantation owner, who tells her, remove her application or get off his land. And she tells him somewhat famously, well, I didn't go down there to register for you. I went down there to register for myself. And he throws her off the land. Yeah. Or the man I was staying with in a little bitty town, Ruleville, Mississippi, Joe McDonald. Ruleville had back then 1,100 people. So it didn't take but a half an hour before everybody in town knew you were there, in this case, including the mayor and the sheriff and all the other bad guys. And the Knight Riders come through and shoot up the Black community. And the mayor accuses me of doing it. He says, what I'm trying to do, I'm failing. So I needed some publicity. So I shot up. And he has me arrested. And he hands me over to the brother of the man who murdered Emmett Till.
Wow.
And I'm hauled off to jail. But it's an attempt to intimidate. He lets me go the next morning. But he's confiscated the shotgun of the man I'm staying with.
And most of the men you stayed with, interacted with, including Dr. King, had weapons.
Everybody. I never stayed in a home in the rural South that didn't have a gun or guns. In many instances, if they were involved with the movement, they often had more than one gun. Now, Reverend King had guns in his home in Montgomery, Alabama, when he first came there and began to emerge as a civil rights leader. And I tell the story, I think, in the book of a journalist, William Worthy, coming to interview Reverend King and beginning to sit down in an armchair, and he's with Bayard Rustin, and Bayard yells out to Bill Worthy, who was the journalist, Bill, there's a couple of guns on that chair.
Be careful.
And King tells them that it's just for self-defense. This is 1956.
Did you buy that?
Yeah, I did. I think that's what, it's not clear whether King owned the guns, whether the guns belonged to somebody else who was protecting him, but the guns were definitely in the house he was a Southern man.
Sure. So then why did you feel, because this narrative has become so embedded in our national consciousness that these people rose up, led by Dr. King, inspired in part by Gandhi's movement of nonviolent resistance to throw off the British in colonial India, that this narrative that's taken hold that nonviolence was the key to it all, why did you feel it was important to deconstruct that and give a more accurate depiction of what happened?
Precisely because of what you just said at the end, to give a more accurate portrait of what was happening. You know, I think huge chunks of the Southern movement are not understood. They're absent from the narrative. As a writer, I want to fill in some of these gaps, particularly as a writer that comes out of that Southern movement. I've been a working reporter, journalist, most of my life since leaving the South. And one of the earliest lessons I learned as a reporter was that news that the public understands and gets is shaped more by what's left out than any bias that creeps in. Hmm. That people's opinions are shaped by what they don't know. Because you can spot bias pretty easily. So I'm trying to add to the body of information about the movement, correct, if you will, what I think is wrongly understood about the movement. And I recognize also that the United States is not very good with history. It doesn't matter, civil rights history, Civil War history, mm-hmm. the American Revolution. It's just not.
We're very good at revisionist history.
Well, also, it's just not good at it. And so, and in this country, more so than in other countries I've been in, U.S. history tends to be built around iconic figures and iconic moments, and not so much about around the substantive flow of thought and events that took place. So mm-hmm. if you want to talk about the Southern Civil Rights Movement, it's been really reduced to Martin Luther King and perhaps Rosa Parks. If you want to talk about what happened to the Southern movement negatively, that boils down to Stokely Carmichael shouting out Black Power. I mean, these are iconic figures, and they do have important roles that they played, but it's not.
It's not the whole story.
Sure. Or even most of the story.
And calls flowing in right now for Jacksonville author and award-winning journalist Charlie Cobb as we discuss his new book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. Let's go now to Marie in Mandarin. Marie, good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Okay. All this talk about violence and nonviolence, I mean, there was both. I'm 73. I lived through all that. And you very seldom hear on TV, radio, discussions about all this. Lyndon Johnson was president at the time, and if it wasn't for him, we may not even have civil rights today. And I think it just takes, you know, a president to be bold and forward and have a conscience like he did and stand up and do the right thing. You know, to me, that's you know, why we have civil rights, because we had a president who, you know, did what he was elected to do.
Well, sure, Marie, but I'm sure many of the activists from that era would argue that there was quite an incredible amount of pressure on him to do that, which they had built up over decades.
Yeah, but he still didn't have to. There was pressure for him not to. He was from the South, you know, and he had a lot of Southern friends.
Thanks for the call, Marie.
He wanted them and tried. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
It does not diminish what Lyndon Johnson did in signing the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act to make the point that he was responding to pressure that was coming really from the grassroots of the South.
Yeah, and as you said when we began talking, this was really an incredible organizing effort.
Yeah, all I'm saying when it comes to the specific issue of Lyndon Johnson, he didn't just wake up one morning and say, oh, I think I'll sign a Civil Rights Act. I mean, there are real forces out there that he had to respond to. And there's when you make that kind of decision, there's always risk in it, because to decide this way is to alienate those that way. That's a whole political discussion that could be had. But I think what describes the Southern movement is not so much what Lyndon Johnson did, but what describes the Southern movement is what local people in communities did, what they did in St. Augustine here in Florida, or what the students did here in Jacksonville in 1960, or what the people in Mississippi did. I think that's what best describes the movement, and that's why guns are a part of this mix.
And speaking of that important part of the mix, 50 years on, I know you've been asked about this quite a bit as you've been giving interviews. What are your thoughts about Florida's Stand Your Ground law?
I don't see the necessity of it. I don't like the way it's been used so far, but I don't see the necessity of it. I think common law is sufficient to take care of the right to self-defense. Nobody quarrels with the right to self-defense, but stand your ground kind of grays this issue. If we really don't know what Trayvon Martin was thinking as he's being followed by this guy he didn't know. And was Trayvon Martin standing his ground? I think this muddies the water, the stand your ground.
Second Amendment champions have flocked behind the message of your book. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I don't center my book around the Second Amendment, except for one anecdote where I told this man who I was just talking about whose gun was confiscated. I did tell him that the Second Amendment gave him the right to have that gun, and he went down to City Hall in this little bitty town and demanded his gun back and actually got it back. He was a 76-year-old man, and he couldn't read or write and just took our word for it that the U.S. Constitution gave him the right to have a gun, the Second Amendment. I think the Second Amendment gives you the right to bear arms, which is why all the gun people sort of like this book, although they're uncomfortable with other parts of the book. But I think the Second Amendment gives you the right to own a gun. Secondly, I don't like the way this debate about guns is unfolding in the United States right now. I find it incoherent and largely irrelevant to what's at play in the sense, in terms of gun violence, in terms of gun possession. I'm not a member of the National Rifle Association. Don't particularly like the National Rifle Association since it was taken over in the mid-1970s. But I do hold the view that guns don't kill people. People kill people.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.